ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Is there a meal that reminds you of a certain person or a particular point in time? My favourite aunt's coleslaw springs to mind for me. It's featured at some wonderful family meals with friends and kids and great conversations and lots of big belly laughs. And that elusive secret ingredient, which I discovered, is condensed milk. Don't tell anyone. For many of us, though, our relationship with food becomes tied to our actual relationships, the way our parents cooked or the meals we make for a partner or how we teach our children about food. But relationships, as we know, can change. Writer Brian Washington explores this idea in his new novel, Family Meal. It follows three characters, gay men of colour, at pivotal moments of their lives. And food is a beautifully added part of that beautifully told story. Brian Washington, great to have you on Life Matters today.
Thank you so much for having me, Hilary. It means a lot.
Well, I'm wondering if there are any examples that spring to mind from your life of those ways that food becomes tied to our relationships, our relationship with food tied to our relationships with people.
Yeah, I think that for me, what felt really important in Family Meal and just in my own experiences generally is playing with this question of care and how care can be distributed. There are, I think, as many different ways of accepting care as there are people to accept that care. There's many different ways of distributing care as there are people looking to distribute it. And food and the act of care and cuisine is a sort of shared language. What's most interesting to me is when coming from a position of wanting to care for someone, we maybe don't have the language for like what they might need in a particular moment, or maybe what they needed has shifted in some capacity or another. But food is always there, right? The sharing of cuisine as an act of care is always there. It is a source of nourishment. So for me, as well as in the book, it is this question of how can we nourish those around us in a way that's sustainable for them, but also for us.
There's a lovely point where you write elsewhere in an essay about how this massive cooking and baking phase in your teens made your family really happy briefly. Why was that such a relief for them at that point in your life?
That's a really good question. I think that for me, oftentimes, and in that window of my life particularly, a challenge was coming up with a sort of like shared language for affection and for care. I think that particularly if you're coming from like a marginalized background, like you're a queer person, you're some sort of outsider inside of like your immediate community, there can be a challenge to relate to those around you, which isn't to say that it is like a linear journey for anyone. But for me, food was one way in which I could create a shared language. Maybe I didn't have a sort of like acceptance as far as queerness is concerned right off the bat, but the nourishment that a baked good could provide, or the nourishment that like a baked treat could provide, that was more easily translatable at the time. And so it became a really useful in to begin having those other conversations about care and about identity and about how we're able to show up for one another. It was just another tool on the path to having like a longer conversation.
Well, and on that theme of showing up for each other and care and comfort, you wrote a few years ago in the New Yorker, Brian, that there's something to be said about the role of queer bakers. We often end up providing comfort to those who may not have given it to us. Tell us how that played out for you around one dish, bread pudding, and the way you were able to connect to your family over that.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny position that, again, you know, if you're coming from a marginalized position, oftentimes it can be posited that you aren't worthy of the care that is expected from you, or you aren't worthy of that sort of like understanding or acceptance that is still expected from you nonetheless. I think that at that point in my life, I had found this particular vehicle for care, like this bread pudding, like in this particular example. And I knew that this was something that I could conjure. This is something that I could offer as a sort of peace offering on the one hand, but also as a way of sort of like smoothing out relationships that would have otherwise been rocky. And I think that that is, you know, a useful thing, but it's also really distressing that the onus is on like a marginalized individual in order to smooth out those relationships. You know, ideally, we're approaching care from the standpoint of both parties or all parties, wanting to meet one another in the middle, wanting to provide comfort for each other on all fronts. But at that particular time, bread pudding was one way in which I could sort of like begin that journey as far as those conversations are concerned. But also it served as like an entry point for my own understanding of what does care look like for me, or what can care look like for me? What are the possibilities there?
Yeah, I love it, how you write in Family Meal, cooking is care, the act is the care. But that really brought up for me thoughts of when the daily meal becomes a prosaic thing and a part of the labour in a house. How do you deal with that balance between care and, I guess, potential inequity or burden?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think in many different ways, I was trying to unspool that idea in Family Meal. Cooking is, and you know, oftentimes is framed as an act of love. It is, and oftentimes is framed as a sort of act of generosity, but it's still labor, you know, and oftentimes, particularly amongst marginalized folks, particularly amongst women, it is labor that is unheralded. It's labor that is unacknowledged. It's labor that is sort of just expected right off the bat. So what does that do to a relationship? It's still time that's being spent crafting this care, but what happens when it's not appreciated, or what happens when it's neglected, or what happens when the labor or the service is accepted, but the individual is not accepted, or the community is not accepted? I don't think that there are static answers to these questions, but I do think they're essential questions as far as like our general understanding of whether or not and how we're appreciating those who are caring for us.
Well, yeah, there's a passage in your book that just kind of punched me between the eyes. It says, "My grandmother cooked for the family that owned her mother. My mother worked in a restaurant 4 miles from the house they'd live in. It was owned by that same family. This wasn't something we spoke about." Is this book, Family Meal, a way of speaking about that link between those bigger issues of politics and race and economic inequity, and how they can be represented through food?
Yeah, I think it is in a lot of different ways. I mean, if you're writing literary fiction in America, regardless of what you're writing about race, you're writing about equity and inequity, you're writing about community, even if by omission. If race isn't something that is of concern to your characters, then race is still at top of mind in that narrative. It matters that it is not of concern to those characters in the same way that equity and community also matter, regardless of whether they're mentioned explicitly or not. But what's most interesting to me, I think, is finding different ways to create entry points for these conversations. I think that for me, and in Family Meal specifically, utilizing this question of food and utilizing this question of intimacy, utilizing these questions of friendship and family, these are languages that, you know, each of us speak to different degrees. You know, each of us has, in some capacity, experience with family, blood or otherwise. Each of us has some capacity with intimacy or the lack thereof. And each of us has some capacity and experience with nourishment. So I think that this book is one way of trying to take those components that each of us experience, like in our own very particular ways, and use those as jumping points to ask other questions about home and about equity and about community and about how we take care of one another or don't.
Intimacy is a fantastic word to use in relation to food, and it makes me think of the fact, Brian, that you've spoken about, that you travel quite a bit. You split your time between Japan and the US. How do you find that intimacy through food in a place that's less known to you?
Yeah, that's a interesting question, right? And I think that in a lot of ways, like, I write to figure that out. This question of intimacy is interlaced with this question of home for me. Whether or not home is a person or a handful of people, whether or not home is explicitly blood family, or if you're not privy to affection and care from your blood family, whether home is found family, whether home is a dish or whether home is a restaurant. I'm really fortunate to have found care in a number of different places. So, you know, there are certain bars in Osaka that I would think of as home in the same way that I would think of, you know, the sofas of friends in Houston or in Los Angeles as home. Those are both, you know, each of them, they're representative of warmth for me. They're representative of community and care for me. But on their face, at face value, you know, they're quite different from one another. So this question of like, what is home explicitly, or rather, what are the many different possibilities that poem can take is one that I don't think has a static answer for me, but that's what makes it a really interesting question in fiction, because it's one that you can constantly approach from myriad angles.
We're speaking with Brian Washington, a writer whose latest book is called Family Meal. He'll be appearing at the Melbourne Writers Festival very soon. And people are responding to this idea about food and home and identity and love. Helen simply says, food is love, agreeing with Brian's articulation of food and care in the novel. And Margaret says, I have beef and mushroom pies and Vegemite, not together, she says, to remind me of my late partner. Very evocative when you smell and taste the foods that you used to eat together. Send me your thoughts about those meals that you keep returning to, because they remind you of people or they're linked to those relationships in some way, perhaps a complex way for you. 0418 226 576. Brian, the craft around food springs to mind in this discussion too. You wrote this fantastic essay for The Cut where you talked about returning again and again to one particular potato dish recipe of your youth, the potato koroke. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, that's how you say it, koroke.
Koroke. And what did that mean for you to try and perfect that recipe?
I think that in some ways the challenge was figuring out like what perfection looked like as far as that recipe was concerned. My first forays were trying really just to make it work. I could not make it work. I did not have the skill at the time. And once I was able to come up with a language for that particular dish, the question shifted, you know. Is the ideal iteration of koroke for me that which I originally tasted? Is it one that, you know, fits whatever scenario I may find myself in? If I'm cooking for a partner, if I'm cooking for a friend, if I'm cooking for a stranger, if they have certain preferences or predilections, or if they have dietary restrictions, is the perfect iteration of that dish the one that is best in that particular moment? Or is it the original iteration that I had? Or is there an original iteration? Is there a sort of like authentic way of approaching a dish? I think that, you know, this is something that's true for any recipe that we cook. No recipe is static, right? In the same way that no story is static, solely by way of your taking a dish. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, it could be a toast and a poached egg. Just your cooking it, the fact of your hands cooking it in your kitchen or in your situation, all of a sudden it belongs to you. And that I think is like, it's an implicit idea, but it's a really, I think, powerful idea, because that gives us agency in how we would like to care for ourselves and care for others. So koroke in a lot of ways was one means of my parsing through this question of how and what it looks like when we acknowledge what we want, what we actually want, and what happens when what we want or what we think we want shifts, or if it changes depending on where we are or who we're with.
Yeah, I'm having this lovely situation at the moment of watching, as you say, a shared language around food evolve between me and my children as they get to try new dishes that might be old dishes for me, and we incorporate them into our sense of family. And also, you know, when you're talking about cooking for a new partner, it's like, yep, I feel for my partner now who has to learn how to cook things without onion or wheat. Bless him. He's doing a fantastic job. Just finally, Brian, I want to read you this text from Arthur in Sydney. I was fortunate to be raised in the loving Greek family, and every time I make spanakopita and falafel from raw ingredients, I feel my grandmother's beautiful hand on my shoulder. That's such a lovely tactile thing. But there's this quote in your book, one of your characters is translating a book that includes an astounding amount of cooking, and he asked the author why, and she says it was a different way of seeing. What did she mean by that, or what might she mean by that?
I think that in many different ways, it relates to the text that you just read, right? It's a way of inhabiting time, or a different layer of time, if this makes a sort of sense. For example, a dish like okonomiyaki, the first time that, you know, I had that dish, it was cooked by a partner like over a decade ago. I had no concept of what this meal was. It was a cabbage pancake. I didn't know that, you know, such a thing existed, but it was delicious and it stuck with me. And it over the years, I became something that I incorporated into my own repertoire. I brought it back to Houston. I cooked it for friends. I cooked it for partners, and the dish changed. I brought it when I traveled. For a little while, I was in Berkeley. I was staying with a friend who had just had top surgery, so they were, you know, they were laid up, and we were cooking for them, just making them nourish. But they had dietary restrictions, and so in order to accommodate them, you know, this original dish from this person that they had never met. That they never will meet, it changed and it brought them comfort. You know, as I move from place to place, as we move from place to place, the dishes that, you know, we hold dear, they change along with us. And we're in that moment in which we're cooking them, but we're also carrying the moments in which we shared them, or the moments in which we learned about them, or the moments in which we first experienced them. Each time that we spend time with that dish, and each time that we change and shift that dish, I think this is one of the ideas I was trying to circle around with that line.
Yeah, food is time travel. Brian, it's been fascinating speaking with you today. Thanks for your time. Enjoy the festival.
Thank you so much for having me. It means a lot.
It's a pleasure. Brian Washington's latest novel is called Family Meal, and he is appearing at the Melbourne Writers Festival soon.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.